Jeff Carr, General Counsel of FMC Technologies, in another interview, talks about the DuPont model and compares this model to his own expectations when interacting with outside counsel for FMC. Jeff talks about how the law firm needs to partner with the corporate law department, collaborating together, as contrasted to the traditional vendor-buyer relationship. Collaboration produces a more effective representation at a lower cost to the company without discounting either the value or the per-hour fee of the lawyer. Although alternative pricing is an important topic that will likely appear again in our podcast, this is the last interview in our current series on the topic.
Our focus today is something is a topic that I think most lawyers have heard about, and I suspect most lawyers really don't truly understand. It's the DuPont model, the model of a new way of corporate counsel dealing with outside law firms. And I know that you're a champion of the alternative billing method, and you follow as a guideline perhaps some of the DuPont approaches, but have taken a very much different aspect in your own company, FMC Technologies. And perhaps you can help us by describing what the DuPont model actually is, and then perhaps how we can talk about how that differs from what you're doing.
Sure, be happy to. The DuPont model, I mean, it's always hard to talk to someone who's not with DuPont about exactly what the DuPont model is, but I am pretty familiar with it, and Tom Sager and Julie Massa and I are good friends and talk frequently. DuPont really is on the forefront of a new way of doing business with counsel. And the model itself, I think, started, maybe 10 years ago or so, maybe, actually, I think 11 now. It's really focused, at least the first iteration of it was focused on convergence, or what's been called convergence, and that's reducing the number of primary law firms. And DuPont's done an excellent job at reducing their number of providers to a more reasonable number, consolidating work, getting better results for that work, being able to use volume-based discounting, but even more than anything else, I think, getting the law firms to think about being a partner with the DuPont legal team itself. And I think that's probably the core of the model, is to foster an environment of collaboration as opposed to an environment of kind of vendor buyer relationships.
Well, that's a really important change, and maybe you can elaborate on that a little bit. I know that in the food industry, which was my background a number of years ago, the major supermarkets began to, at that time we didn't have the word converge for this concept, but they began to reduce the number of distributors and deliveries to the back door. And one of the reasons they did that was their perception that when the back door of the supermarket was open, or the front door of the warehouse, however it was, merchandise tended to sprout legs. and they had a disappearance issue. And they also had an issue of dealing with many different invoices. So they had an accounting cost issue. Now, I suspect that in the legal profession, the accounting cost issue would be similar. But clearly, there's nothing that sprouts legs here in this example, is there?
I suppose the only thing that could sprout legs are uncontrolled hours. That would be the only thing that I think I would worry about. But if you've got a good culture of collaboration and communication, you should be able to deal with that with your outside counsel. They shouldn't be doing things that you don't want them to be doing, and everybody should understand what exactly you want from your outside counsel. I think if you talk to the folks at DuPont today, they're trying to focus even more on improving results and lowering costs through a partnering model, on seeking growth for the network itself. In other words, helping the network providers, their preferred law firms, grow their own business, not necessarily just with DuPont, but with other players as well, And then also to seek growth for DuPont itself, as an example, looking for business opportunities for DuPont itself. Those, along with diversity, those are the elements, I think, that DuPont is really pushing. And I think that's what many of us are pushing right now as well.
Well, I can understand how DuPont or FMC could help law firm A get more business by talking to your colleagues and so forth and say, you've got a great law firm. Go see law firm A, not law firm B or D or F.
Right.
That I can understand. How is it that the law firm can help FMC or DuPont, for that matter, get more business for it?
That's a great question, Ed. And I know what DuPont's doing now. They have a very, very interesting experiment going on. They focused on their flooring systems business, which is carpeting and other types of flooring materials. And what they're doing is they're asking their law firms, if their law firms are aware of law firm clients that are about to engage in a significant physical plant expansion, new plant or renovation, to see if they can get salespeople from DuPont in the door to make a pitch about selling them DuPont flooring materials. Really asking the lawyers, it's just for leads. It's not to be to promote DuPont products. It's just, you know, can you get us in the door to talk to people? That's very, very interesting. For FMC Technologies, we're not really a consumer products company. It's a little harder for us to ask our law firms to go out and say, hey, you know, do you know anybody that needs to buy a passenger boarding bridge in an airport or a wellhead? So it's a little tougher for us. But I do think that the model is very interesting, and I hope DuPont's very successful with it.
Well, that is fascinating. That's turning the tables on the lawyer, because that's exactly what the lawyer asks the client to do.
Exactly right. Exactly right. In our case, what we're doing is we're asking our law firms to promote our legal services model to their other clients, because in our view, that helps them become more profitable. And it satisfies our interest in promoting a different way to buy legal services. So that's our version of this DuPont sort of collaborative marketing effort.
One of the things as an outsider that I see is that when DuPont or any of the other major corporate purchasers of legal services talks about reducing their law firms, the number of their law firms with which they work, from 200 or 300, or in one case I saw 400, down to 1 or 7 or 8,
right,
something like that. You know, it shocks me in one sense, not so much for the folks that are successful in retaining that relationship, but what do the other law firms do? I mean, what's happening to the industry?
Right, right. Well, and they're losing business from those clients. We have exactly the same model. I run a monthly report that looks at our level of fees, where they're going, and I do sort of a 90-10% cut. And 90% of our legal spend today goes to 10 law firms. Now, we probably use, I think about 35 firms for various things, but many of those things are minor one-off questions that you need a specialized piece of advice for. But the core of our legal work is being concentrated now in 10 firms. What I find interesting about that is you'll often hear in-house lawyers say, we all say this, we all use this, we say we hire lawyers, we don't hire firms. Came to my attention the other day that, you know, that's only partly true. We really are moving more to hiring firms now, and we're really looking for firms. We should say we hire lawyers, and we mean in the plural. We don't mean a lawyer at a firm. We mean we're hiring groups of lawyers that share our philosophy for the delivery of legal services, and that means a fewer number of firms involved, because it's easier for us. It's easier to get the cultural fit, and we want to reduce our administrative costs associated with using a whole series of vendors.
One of the things that comes to mind in terms of the concept of lowering legal costs is the concept of I don't want to use the word, but I'm going to use the word, forcing one law firm to share its knowledge, its research, with another law firm in a different part of the country that you deal with that is facing a similar, if not the same, legal issue.
Yep.
Is that part of what you mean when you say collaboration?
Absolutely right. And DuPont does that as well. They have a knowledge bank that's all built on a, I think they use a Lotus Notes platform that all of the law firms have access to. We do the same kind of thing with a system called Serengeti, an externally based ASP solution that our firms can go into and try to harvest work that's been done elsewhere so that we're never starting from ground one. One of the things that I like to say is the only thing I hate more than answering the same question twice is paying to answer the same question twice. And we're trying to get our firms to think that way. We had, a failed experiment over the past 2.5 years where we put firms that were handling similar types of litigation, and we kind of put them in a box together. Any given firm might be handling one particular case, but all these cases were similar. And so we said, okay, we expect to spend, say, $1 million this year on this kind of litigation, and there might be 4 or 5 firms that are handling it. Well, then we also took a legal research provider, LRC, and put them in this group, so we've got five firms plus LRC, and we said, look, guys, we want you all to talk about each other, leverage your collective knowledge, and provide us the best possible service. Each case has a risk-reward component to it, but we're also going to look at the entire portfolio and say, if we get savings from our expected spend of, say, $1 million, then we're going to share those savings, 40% to FMC Technologies and 10% apiece to each one of you firms that are in this network, because we want to encourage you to work together. What that means is you could have a firm that didn't handle a single case for us, but if we had savings, they might get a bonus simply because they're in the sandbox and they're playing well. I characterize that as an interesting theoretical construct, but it didn't work for us. We did it for about 2.5 years, and we did not get the savings that we wanted, and so we've just changed it. Now, DuPont has done a very similar thing in their Kumaran litigation, very similar kind of a bonus structure for their firms. I think why they've been successful and why we were not is that they had more money at stake, and so there was more interest in the firms of sharing that knowledge and getting some bonuses. They paid some substantial bonuses out, and I applaud them for doing that. In our case, we just didn't have enough money at stake, I think, to make it interesting for the firms. So instead, we've moved to a different kind of incentive. We have many of our firms on a retainer basis, and as part of their report card evaluation that we use, one of the criteria is how well they play in the sandbox and how much they share. And if they do a good job in that, they're going to get a bonus for it.
And that's unrelated to whatever the total or collective does.
That's correct.
Let me go back to the question that I mentioned earlier and ask your opinion, ask you to get your crystal ball out. What do you see happening to those firms who are on the outside, who are not getting the contract to be part of the 10 that are serving you? Mm-hmm. I mean, that makes the competition, so to speak, that much fiercer. It impacts the 60 or 70% of the profession that already are either solos or small firms that is under 5.
Right.
What's going to happen to the profession? Are we, for the first time, going to have way too many lawyers, or are we going to find new ways to serve people whose needs currently are not met?
I think, Ed, both. To quote Mark Twain, a small town that can't support one lawyer can always support two. So there's always
going to be... I hadn't heard that one before.
Well, there's always going to be work out there. And some of it, frankly, is generated by lawyers creating work. But I think you are going to see a shift. On the one hand, you're going to see corporate clients that are going to move to a fewer number of providers. What's interesting is whether or not those providers are going to be small-scale firms, or are they going to be these big mega firms. And I could make the argument either way. In my view, the mega firms generally have an overhead cost structure that makes them cost prohibitive to use. You know, they hire too many young associates without any experience that don't provide any value to me as a client, and I'm unwilling to pay for that training cost. So we gravitate sort of naturally to mid-sized regional firms, specialty firms to handle a large portion of a particular kind of our business. And so we may line up, FMC Technologies, we may line up 10 different firms that have a sectoral expertise, but give them all of our work in that area, in that sector. In other words, give them competitive immunity, if you will, within that slice of our particular market. It doesn't mean we won't work with mega firms. It's just that they've got to come to a way of providing us more efficient, cost-effective service, and they got to deal with their issue of their overhead costs because we're simply not willing to pay for that overhead cost. So I think we're in a very interesting environment right now. When I take the crystal ball out, I think the firms that are going to win in the long run are not necessarily the mega firms, unless the mega firms can figure out how to use their collective knowledge that they've got in this mega firm to reduce the cost of service to the client. Then there'll be value there. If they don't do that, I think forward-looking clients will go to, you know, these smaller specialized providers that we're not paying the overhead for. We're paying their expertise. And we're, in a sense, what we're doing is we're building our own law firm. You know, I mean, I kind of look at myself as a managing partner of the FMC Technologies law firm. And I'm picking smaller firms or smaller practice groups at big firms to provide the services that my law firm, FMC Technologies law firm, needs. That's our version of the future. It's building a virtual law firm, picking and choosing from the elements that we need. I don't know if that answers your question.
But. Yeah, it does. I mean, it's a novel way, I think, of looking at this, but I think it's, you know, right on. I think that's, in reality, what's happening by the more progressive corporations in America, if not the world, mm-hmm. and the change that's happening in the law firms as well. It kind of reminds me that change is never desired, you know, the book Who Moved My Cheese, but change comes anyway. And I think the insurance companies have forced the change in thinking about alternative fees and arrangements for fees. And I think that what you're talking about right now is perhaps the catalyst for what I think is going to be the essential ingredient for the survival of any law firm, and that's using the term knowledge management.
Right.
I remember when I was chief operating officer of a law firm in the late 80s that we had there, I brought in the concept of knowledge management because we brought in a brand new computer system.
Right.
And since we started from zero, I was able to begin the thought process of how we develop a tree of knowledge. We didn't know then the term knowledge management. But in fact, that's what I was beginning to build. And what I found during my tenure there is that it was very, very expensive to do. It's
right.
very time consuming because you can't have a non-lawyer do it. You've got to have somebody experienced who can evaluate the quality of the work to know whether you want that in your bank. And my experience in today's world is that most law firms don't want to take the time. They're not willing to spend the money because they see it as an expense, not an investment. And I think they may be forced into this in the kind of context that you're creating.
I think that's right. And it is money well spent. But I think at least our view on knowledge management is it needs to, for it to be effective, it needs to get out of the realm where human interaction is necessary. And until recently, tools really haven't existed to harvest the embedded knowledge in a corporation very well. But I think we have an interesting convergence of events. One is that, you know, most of embedded knowledge in a company today is in a digital format in one way or another. And then the second is just powerful computing programs and the Google-type approach to life. I mean, in a perfect world, I ought to be able to enter a search term in a search engine like Google and say, I want everything about X. And that would search my computer, my internal network, my extranet, if you will, and then also the Internet, and deliver back to my desktop responsive documents to that. Now, those might reside at one of my law firms who's in our network, on our extranet. And so the scary part for law firms here is the ability for folks like me to reach into their systems and try to find something that might be responsive to my needs. I view that as making me a better consumer of legal services, making me more able to frame a question so that I can use their expertise as opposed to asking them to reinvent the wheel all the time. Now, the challenge here, I think, is moving to this next step. It's breaking down some barriers within the law firms. They still, you know, it's an amazing concept that they think that they actually own the files. You know, the client owns the files. Now, there is an issue about something that's been done for one client. You know, to what extent can that be shared with another client? I know from my perspective, I'd be happy to share any documents that could be stripped of sort of identifying information with anybody else that wanted to see it. You know, if I were in a network with Tom Sager at DuPont and Steve Gates over at ConocoPhillips and Craig Glidden at Chevron Phillips, and we could collectively put all of our law firms in the same network and search one another's prior work product, I'd be great about that. You know, now there are obviously some confidentiality issues, and those could be dealt with various ways, but that's the real holy grail of knowledge management in my world. It's just being able to search out wherever that information may be and deliver it back to me to make me a better consumer of legal services. Now, I'm reminded, though, by a saying that I think I can attribute this to Craig Glidden at Chevron Phillips. He says knowledge management is a lot like teenage sex. There are a lot of more people talking about it than doing it, and those that are doing it don't have a clue about what they're doing.
I love that. But your description just blew my box away, because I never thought, for example, of a consortium of corporations sharing their legal research on all these various topics. I mean, that really takes it to, in my mind, the nth degree.
Well, that's where, at least from my standpoint, I'd like to go. And I know that there are a lot of other GCs out there. I may be crazy, but I'm not alone. You know, there are people out there that think this way.
Well, that certainly takes it far afield from where we are today. And my hope was that we could just get the law firms to share, you know, with one client. That is, share information with other lawyers for one client. And now you're really moving the ball or the cheese, however we want to look at that.
Well, we like to think of ourselves as constantly being on the bleeding edge.
Okay. We have to keep enough blood in the system, however, to keep the system working.
Well, that's right. That's right. And that's absolutely right. And the idea here is not, this has to be a win-win. I mean, we can't do this at the expense of our firms. It is not in any of our interest, the corporate buyers, to put our firms out of business. It is in our interest to change the way they deliver legal services to us. And we need to partner with the firms to find better ways to do it.
I like the concept of collaboration, and it's a concept that I think we're not taught in law school. It's a concept that's just hammered out of us, even if we had it when we first entered the law school threshold.
Yeah.
And we're going to have to get back to that in some fashion in order to achieve the ideals that you're setting out for us.
I think that's absolutely right. You know, I think one of the great things that we could do for the lawyers in America is make them all go to a seminar that's put on by this group called Afterburners. Afterburners is a corporate training organization that's made up entirely of fighter pilots, either Air Force, Navy, or Marine fighter pilots that are now reservists or whatever. And if you think about it, lawyers are an awful lot like a fighter pilot. We all know that we're better, smarter, faster than anybody else in the room, and we don't need any help. I mean, it is a uniquely individual activity. What a good fighter pilot will tell you is if you have that kind of ego, that's a real good way to run a $40 million aircraft into the side of a mountain or into the ocean. And the way that you succeed as a fighter pilot is by breaking down those barriers, your own ego, and relying on all the members of the team, the person that's on your wing, the person that loaded your plane, the person that did the briefing on what the target package was, the AWACS commanders that are telling you where to go, you know, all of the various assets that you have at your disposal. That's the way you succeed when you're alone in the cockpit of a fighter plane. And I think lawyers can learn a lot from that. The way we succeed is by breaking down our egos and saying, you know, even though I know I'm the best lawyer in the world, you know, I can use some help from some other people. And why don't I leverage the collective force at my disposal to achieve the objective? If we thought that way, we'd give better customer service. But we're not taught that in law school. We're also not taught, and the business model in law firms doesn't permit it, because the business model in a law firm is all based upon number of hours and leverage on those hours.
And it's based on who presumptively has control of the client.
Correct. And there are very few law firms that look at the world the way a company does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most law firms are not organized along sort of product lines. They might have practice groups, but they don't. They compensate people on the basis of individual contribution as opposed to enterprise contribution. They don't look at profitability of particular projects. Most of them have no idea what their cost of goods sold is for any particular project. All they know is, here are my costs and here are my revenue. I'm either making money or I'm not making money. But most of them don't really have a clue as to whether they're making money on that particular item or how they might reduce the cost of that item so that they can increase their profit margin, but at the same time give better service to the client.
Right. Jeff, let me go back with you for a moment and talk about some of the specifics of the DuPont model.
Sure.
And ask you to bring us down from the 50,000-foot level to the ground level or close to it.
Okay.
And tell us how it actually works, and tell us how you differ, how FMC has taken a different path where it has.
Sure. I think one of the things that we differ with DuPont is that DuPont, one of their goals is to use alternative billing. But if you talk to Tom and Julie and others at DuPont, they'll tell you that they do that, but they don't do it as much as they would like to. Still, many of the engagements are on a billable hour basis, maybe with a volume-based discount. We at FMC Technologies, we've gone kind of the other way. And we've said that we're going to do all of our work on an alternative fee basis, and if you're going to engage counsel on some basis, on just a straight hourly basis, that's a deviation from our procedures, and you have to have my approval to do it. And so we're trying to impose discipline on the in-house counsel to make sure that we actually use alternative fees. One of the reasons we can do that is I've got a legal team of 8 people. It is easier to control that and impose that discipline in an 8-person law firm. If you're 120, 150, 170 lawyers in a department, it's much, much harder to do that. And so I think that's just scale-wise, it's a little easier for us to implement than it is for DuPont.
When you talk about alternative fees, there are obviously many different kinds of alternatives.
Right.
Does it matter which alternative your folks are choosing, or just that it's not hourly billing?
No, we have a model that we call ACES, the Alliance Counsel Engagement System. There's kind of 2 iterations of it. One is a report card system that basically is performance-based pay. We give people a report card. There's a certain amount of compensation at risk. We give them a report card, and based upon their report card, they get somewhere between 80 and 120% of the amount that they billed us. We have a little more complex model for litigation tries to align phase targets with success and efficiency. Those are our two primary models. If somebody wants to, we will entertain other models, but those would also be a deviation and would have to be approved.
And what are some of the other specifics that we can talk about comparing DuPont with your company, FMC?
I think a lot of it is really size and scale. I mean, they have a they're a much bigger company. They have a lot more matters than we do. The businesses that they're in tend to generate mass tort issues that we don't have. We're a product manufacturer as opposed to a chemical manufacturer. So we're not a consumer products manufacturer. So we tend to not get involved too much in mass tort or environmental type claims. We just don't have the same kind of scale as DuPont. So because of that, it's a little easier, I think, for us to focus on some of these relationship issues than it is for DuPont. They have just the sheer number of cases they have. Now, the interesting part about that is they, of course, have much more buying power than we do because they've got such a huge legal spend. My external legal spend is only about $10 million a year, which is not a lot of money in this world. So we can't use buying power to cajole our firms into doing what we want. We have to use the blunter instruments of either firing them or using firms that are more progressive. DuPont at least can say, hey, I've got a substantial amount of spend here. If you want a piece of this, you have to play my way. I just don't have that at my disposal to use.
But yet, because of what you do have, you've got smaller a microcosm and can experiment perhaps a little bit more easily.
I think that's right. You know, I think our smaller size, smaller spend does help us. I think that's absolutely right, Ed. We are able to look at these things as kind of a laboratory, and it's easier for us to change, too. If we're finding something that's not working, like that team-based incentive that I described a little while ago, it's easier for us to say, you know, this is a failed experiment, it didn't work, let's try something new, and let's go ahead and do that. And we can execute on that pretty quickly when we need to.
You have been listening to a LawBiz podcast. For more podcasts, please visit www.lawbiz.com/podcasts.html. Feel free to tell your friends and colleagues about LawBiz podcasts. You may duplicate this program in part or in whole, provided that you retain appropriate attribution and copyright notices.